everyone, and welcome to episode 15 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Maybe you are creating a role-playing game character for yourself, or maybe you are looking into a historic battle for a medieval throne, but chances are at one time or another you've come across a strange and contradictory character from the Middle Ages, the warrior cleric. Although priests and other members of the clergy were not meant to shed blood, and especially not to break the Ten Commandments, from time to time there were men in the Middle Ages who took "thou shalt not kill" with a grain of salt. From fierce fathers to battling bishops, clergy took part in some of the major conflicts of the age, saving souls and cracking skulls. This week, I spoke to Dr. Craig Nakashian, author of Warrior Churchmen of Medieval England, 1000 to 1250, Theory and Reality, to learn more about these fascinating figures. Craig is an associate professor of history, chair of the history department, and director of the honors program at Texas A&M University, Texarkana. He's also the book review editor for De Re Militari, the Society for Medieval Military History, and the co-editor of Prowess, Piety, and Public Order in Medieval Society, Studies in Honor of Richard W. Kuyper. Here's our conversation on canon law and conflict, why the clergy sometimes got involved, and whether or not your RPG cleric should be restricted to only using blunt weapons. Thanks, Craig, for joining me to talk about warrior priests and warrior clergy. I am so happy to have you here.
I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
So, let's start with the basics. Clergy were not supposed to be violent, were they?
Not generally speaking. Not in the Middle Ages, no. That's true.
And yet they were. So how did this happen?
Just simple question, right?
Simple question.
Yeah, I think it happened, obviously, for a whole bunch of different reasons, right? And in the book, we talk a little bit about this, the colloquial. One, you know, certainly is sort of a social position, right? A lot of your high-ranking clerics, your bishops and others, they are coming out of the nobility for the most part, or the warrior class. And so I think there's a certain familiarity with it. I think of somebody like an Ordoric Vitalis who was very familiar with knights, and he's not entirely sure how separate he is from them, but he's pleased he's not one of them. Or Guibert de Nogent, who makes the very clear sort of comment that he's really glad his father died young, otherwise he would have made him become a knight instead of a cleric. But, you know, it's all the same kind of families. So, yeah, there's some of that. A lot of the clerics that I look at who are bishops and others, you know, Henry of Winchester or Henry of Blois, King Stephen's brother, Odo Abayo, obviously William I's half-brother. They're all sort of pretty easy circulating around the highest classes there. That's part of it. I think the other reason why they do it, and I guess that there's a sort of base level utility to violence in the Middle Ages, right? And so one of the things I talk about in the book is that, you know, while there is this effort in the 11th and 12th centuries especially, but, you know, both before and after as well, to sort of disassociate clerics from war the same way that they were trying to disassociate clerics from sex and from surgery and bloodshed in general and simony and all those other terrible kind of worldly sins that they were guilty of, the violence had an element of utility to it. And it had an element of, so there's this utility element where, like, it's useful, right? It's meaningful to kill somebody, especially if you disagree with them, it helps. But there's also a glorious element to violence in the Middle Ages, right? And that's something that, you know, had I gone back to write the book now, I would probably talk about more. You know, ironically, my training as a historian was, you know, at the PhD level based around this someone who studies chivalry. And I didn't really talk much about chivalry in the book, which was somewhat confusing to some of the people who read it, because that is something that I should have expanded on, that, like, violence was a path towards honor, and violence was, you know, licit violence was this this great glorifying thing in the Middle Ages, or it could be. And so I think that had something to do with it. You know, I hit the utility side of it pretty hard, that, you know, ultimately violence was something that could do good in society. So the example that I start the book with comes from one of my favorite historians of the Middle Ages, William of Newburgh. It's like late 12th century English historian. And he tells this great story about these two bishops up in Scotland, one of whom gets it in his head that he should have the Earldom of Moray under his control. So he puts together like a raiding army and he starts going around the coast and pillaging, and King David can't do anything about it. Clearly, this guy's a terrible person, this bishop. And the only time he gets defeated is when this other bishop, who remains unnamed in the chronicle, actually puts together an army and like goes and meets him in the field of battle. And William is very clear that right before, you know, when the battle started, they're both standing in front of their armies, and the unnamed bishop throws an axe at the other bishop and hits him in the chest and like knocks him down. He doesn't kill him, but that this was sort of like the righteous hand of God, basically. And so they're both doing the same thing. Canonically, they're both like bad because, you know, you shouldn't throw axes at your opponents if you're a bishop. But culturally, clearly the anonymous bishop was the good guy. I mean, he was the one who was defending his flock. He was the one that was, you know, looking out for his people. And so I liked that story because it sort of illuminated very quickly the basic discussion in the Middle Ages about the utility of violence by clerics. And you can even go, you know, further back in the Book of St. Foix. There's a discussion about that. The author makes the point clearly that if you think that a bishop's job is just to look out for people's souls rather than defend their lives, then you're missing the point. You know, so there is this sort of undercurrent of righteous violence being okay. The normative reformers hated it. You know, there was plenty of that. And that, I think, is the dominant discourse in the Middle Ages. But because I'm at heart a contrarian, I don't like the dominant narrative. You know, I recognize that most clerics didn't fight in wars. Most of them did what they were supposed to do. You know, if they were on the battlefield at all, they were praying and they were looking out for the souls of the warriors and all that. And that's fine. The guys I'm looking at are exceptional by intention, but I don't think that means we can dismiss them.
So
that was a long answer to a short question. Sorry.
It was a complicated question. So when we're talking about these warrior clergy, in the case of your book, you're talking about individuals and you're not talking about the military orders, for example, right?
Right. Yeah. I kind of dodged that one a little bit. I specifically, when I'm looking at the clerics, I'm focusing primarily on English clerics. And that was, again, sort of intentional. There's a couple of French folk who pop up as well. The Bishop of Beauvais towards the end of the 1100s. Is one who gets in there, I think Philip of Dreux. But for the most part, it's English clerics, and it's between that 1066 and, you know, 1240 kind of period, because I think that that's really kind of an interesting time of this sort of canonical figuring out of what the quote-unquote church thinks about stuff. You know, we're moving from these kind of regional councils to established books of canon law and all of that. But the military orders specifically, you know, so I was interested on kind of, you know, bounding it temporally and geographically that way. Also because the English are always kind of a little wacky with what they're doing, so you're likelier to find some fun stuff. And the military orders, though, are kind of an interesting group because I guess I just never really thought of them as clerics in the traditional sense. You know, so because I was trying to get at this, and one of the areas that I never really, I don't think, did a great job clarifying in the book was who I'm specifically talking about. So, like, the title of the book is Warrior Churchman, and that's kind of an intentional, I don't want to say obfuscation, but an intentional dodge a little bit to avoid getting into these very technical arguments about who was a cleric and who wasn't. The definition, because I was looking at it from sort of a cultural receptivity standpoint, I was interested in like what chroniclers thought about this and what, you know, your average monk hanging out writing an annal or a chronicle thinks about these guys. I basically adopted the notion that if they thought of them as clerics, like if they thought of them as men of the church rather than something else, I kind of used it. And so for the military orders, I recognize that that plenty of people sort of thought of them like that, but I think they sort of consciously put an asterisk next to them, that like being a Templar, it's not the same as being a bishop. It's not the same as even being a traditional monk. It's sort of, yeah, it's something different. It's a good thing for a knight to do who wants to try to avoid burning in hell. Go do that. Go be a Templar. But it's not the same as being consecrated as a bishop. And so I was more interested in the guys who had been consecrated as bishops, even though a lot of the same arguments that I was running into, there are things that happened in the military orders as well. Not so much the Templars, I suppose, but definitely like the Hospitallers. I mean, there was a major argument in the 12th century over how militaristic they should be, you know, by, I think it's the 1160s and 70s, they're having these arguments about how much should they be embracing violence. And so I talk about that in the introduction a little bit, but I sort of leave it aside as saying, you know, in some ways that's kind of a different argument because that's more for knights rather than for clerics.
Right. I just wanted to distinguish the two because we know that military orders were people that took vows, religious vows, but they were also fighters sort of by definition.
Right.
So when you're talking about the type of warrior priests that you study, you're looking at bishops mainly. So what kind of conflicts would they find themselves embroiled in? Like, would they just be fighting over territory, like this Scottish example? Would they be involved in family disputes? What kind of conflicts would they get involved in?
In the case of the folks that I looked at, generally speaking, they were fighting in broader military campaigns, usually as a component of the royal government. And so, again, one of the areas that I talk a little bit about is that connection between the cleric and the king. And there's a lot of interesting kind of narrative stuff going on there that was intentional among the 12th century folks about what the role of a cleric was in supporting the king. And so I think a lot of that gets folded into this discussion as well, that these bishops aren't usually fighting each other for territory. Like I said, the Bishop of the Isle of Man was a little bit of an exception up in Scotland. So like in England, you don't necessarily see Hubert Walter going around attacking nobles to take their castles or anything like that. Usually they're operating as agents of the king. And so I think that then lends a certain licitness to what they're doing as well. I think part of the reason why these guys are not being condemned necessarily, unless you politically disagreed with them, then it was okay, is because they're usually fighting for the licit authority. They're not usually fighting against the king. They're usually fighting for the king. And so it's when they go against that, that they often kind of run into trouble. You know, Odo of Bayeux, for instance, is a great example. You know, I was just reading some stuff about him this morning for a different project. And, you know, folks like Orderic are very clear that the reason Odo gets arrested in 1082 is because he's like putting his interests above that of his brother, the king. And this makes him a tyrant for the most part, or makes him selfish or worldly. And that's really the big concern, that these guys are going to be worldly. But generally speaking, I think that most of the campaigns you'd find them in would be larger scale royal campaigns where they're serving as kind of an agent of at least the legitimate power. If you look at somebody like Peter de Rocher in the early 13th century, who is fighting on behalf of the young Henry III during the period after John's death, when you've got the French in London and all that stuff, he's like on the side of the now future and legitimate king. So that's okay. You know, and you get really great positive write-ups about him in the history of William Marshall and so forth, of riding alongside Marshall leading the army and saying, you know, God is with the Marshall, that kind of stuff.
That's exactly the type of thing that should be in the Marshall's biography.
Yeah, that specific example is pretty entertaining. I think I wrote about it for the Medieval Warfare magazine, because Marshall, Peter de Rocher, really comes off as like the sort of cool-headed tactician. Like, he went out and reconnoitered the walls, and he realized that there were some areas that they could slip guys in. But as soon as he gets back to the camp and he mentions that there's like a hole, Marshall just charges like a bat out of hell, doesn't even put his helmet on. And so de Rocher is like, oh, crap, you know, so here we go, I guess we're attacking, you know. God's with the Marshal, follow him. So, but he actually ends his career. You know, he loses political favor in England, and he actually ends his career leading the Pope's armies down in Italy in the 1230s. So, being a warrior was not necessarily a barrier to advancement in the medieval church for bishops, provided they did it the right way, provided they fought for licit causes rather than for themselves, and provided that I guess that's the big one, that they weren't fighting for worldly reasons, because that's really where a lot of this normative complaint is coming from, that we don't want clerics who are worldly. And that goes back to, you know, first century. But violence wasn't always seen as just inherently worldliness. I mean, it had a licit component to it. And so long as they were part of that, they got a heck of a lot more leeway, and they could get accolades for it as well. It's not just excuses. They could get praise for doing it.
Is this something that you found that the kings would ask them to do, would be to take up arms? Or is this something that you get the sense they sort of volunteered to do?
I think it depends. It depended on the king specifically. Some kings were, I think, happier with it than others. And, you know, if we use somebody like a Richard the First, for instance, he never really seems to have any particular problem with Hubert Walter doing stuff, mostly on the Third Crusade. There's no evidence that he's sitting there saying, hey, you know, Walter, sit back in the camp while we go off and attack the walls. In fact, he writes back to his mother about what a great guy Walter is and how he'd be really good as Archbishop of Canterbury after Baldwin dies. So some kings, I think, are totally on board with it. I don't really get the impression when you read, now, Stephen and Henry's relationship in the Civil War is complicated, I'll put it that way. Henry changes sides a few times. But generally speaking, you don't really we don't have the evidence that Stephen is telling him, hey, you know, back off or anything. In fact, Stephen owes his crown to him in a lot of ways. So he's more than happy so long as he's fighting for him. On the other hand, there are kings who aren't thrilled with this. Not so much English kings, actually, but, you know, Louis the Ninth. You know, Joinville talks about this. There's this great scene in Joinville where the priest kills three royal sergeants who had assaulted him. And it's a very famous scene where he like they beat him up and taunt him. And then he goes home and gets his sword and crossbow. Should tell you something. And he, like, you know, shoots one guy dead, goes and like cuts another one's leg off, and then chases the other one down and kills him. And Louis very clearly, you know, Louis the Ninth very clearly says, you cannot be a priest anymore, but you should become a knight and come to the Holy Land with me because we could use you. You know, whether that's apocryphal or not, clearly the voice of Louis in that is that these things are separate. And so, but you know, Louis was very much kind of a normative reformer type anyway, so it makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah, there were plenty of people who thought there was no licit, violent outlet for clerics. They should just disassociate from it. And I think, you know, Bernard de Clairvaux talks about that when he's talking about the Templars. You know, I can't pick up the sword myself, but you guys can. Which is also why I don't think the Templars were clerics, because Bernard is explicitly saying, we clerics can't pick these swords up, but you Templars can. So
they are in their own space, these military orders.
Yeah, their own little realm.
Yeah, that's right. But you've brought up weapons, so let's go with that. Because
oh, great, yeah.
Because famously, clergy are not allowed to shed blood. And so there's all sorts of really interesting rules about how to get around that in the Middle Ages in general. But you're talking about like this priest with sword and a crossbow. So we have this impression, I think, if we see a warrior priest, that they're going to have something like a club or a mace because they're not supposed to shed blood. So what kind of weapons have you seen these warrior priests using?
That's a great and annoying question, because I'm thinking about writing an article to finally sort of sort this out, because I was introduced to that idea through Dungeons and Dragons, obviously. You know,
That's
my first character was a cleric in second edition, and you were restricted to non-blood spilling weapons. And so I think a lot of that comes to us through the kind of Victorian notion of clerics not being able to shed blood, but still being able to fight. And so you think back to like the Abayo tapestry with Odo, and he's very clearly holding his baculum, which I guess these days we call a staff rather than a mace. I'm not sure it makes much of a difference when you dash someone's brains out with it, but either way. And, you know, the few times that clerical weapons are mentioned in these chronicles when they're actually fighting, yeah, they do tend to be blunt. Like I'm thinking Philip of Dreux at the Battle of Bouvines, Philip the Breton, makes it say, you know, he accidentally found a mace in his hand. So he started using it. You know, like, oh, what's this? Oh, apparently it's a weapon. So I guess most of the evidence is that if they were using weapons, they were blunt. But I don't know how accurate that is necessarily. I guess it would make more sense for them to have a blunt weapon because they would have a staff of office oftentimes. And so that was sort of easier to justify than going around with a sword. Now, you do see it. You do hear chroniclers complain about it. I think it's the author of the Gesta Stefani complains about, you know, bishops riding around in magnificent suits of armor and girt with swords. And so this is this idea that they were wearing swords. But also in terms of the violence, a lot of these clerics, I don't know how actual personal the violence was. You know, sort of like with kings, you know, they weren't always in the thick of the fighting. They were sort of generaling from the back, if you will. And so I don't know how often these clerics were actually swinging the swords themselves or swinging the maces. What's interesting to me is that in the imaginative literature, which is also another direction that I'd like to take more of this, because I love writing about Archbishop Turpin, for instance, they're very clear that they have swords and lances. I mean, they're just knights for the most part. But you do get that interesting discourse, like in the William in the Monastery epic, when he becomes a monk, he can't use any weapon aside from his fists. And I believe the leg of a horse that he tears off and uses for a while. But because it was for a righteous cause, the horse is restored to health. It's okay. It all works out in the end.
Oh, well, thank
Probably
goodness.
not a very fun process, but it all works out. Long story, long dodge out of the way. The few times we actually hear of clerics using weapons specifically themselves personally, rather than, you know, charging into battle or whatever it is, they tend to be blunt. And I don't know that that was necessarily to avoid some sort of canonical prohibition on bloodshed, because the canonical prohibition on being armed and in battle was a heck of a lot more widespread as well. So it wouldn't really do you much good to just be violating two or three of the canons rather than four. But it's also possible that they had these because they were also symbols of office. But I'm gonna actually work on that. I'm gonna try to figure out where that came from. I blame the Victorians. I think that was them. That's just my sort of thought, that it was probably the Victorians. And in chatting with others, I think that's where that miscommunication, where that misapprehension came from. If you're a medieval bishop, smacking someone in the head with a mace is not any more canonically okay than stabbing them with a sword. It's not like they're gonna be like, oh, okay, well, it's fine. It's just a mace.
That's either okay
way.
Then.
Yeah, it's bad. It's bad either way.
Blaming the Victorians is always a safe bet, I think.
I think so. I'm on board with that approach.
But speaking of breaking the rules, we know that this idea of being violent and a member of the clergy was condemned. So what kind of rules did they have around that?
From a canonical standpoint, it was kind of basic in that most of the canons would be pretty straightforward. And again, I'm not really a canon law person. I sort of embrace and interacted with it sort of as little as possible because I was more interested in what the observers thought rather than the lawyers. But, you know, canonically, yeah, you weren't supposed to be armed. Clerics should not be armed. That was a pretty common one. There were some exceptions that developed, especially in the 12th century. Once you let lawyers get a hold of something, they're going to start carving out various little exceptions. And you do see this somewhat in some regional councils as well. I think there's the Council of Nablus in 1120 out in the Holy Land, where clerics are actually fighting in defense of the city against the Muslims. And so that council actually says, hey, it's okay, as long as they're on the wall defending it with everybody else. That's, you know, let's not punish them. But in the general canonical collections, you would occasionally find exceptions, like if you're a cleric and you're going through dangerous areas, you can carry a weapon, but you can't use it. So, there you go. And I can't remember which one of the decretalists, I believe, kind of makes that point that, you know, you can carry it, but you're not actually allowed to use it at any case or in any case.
It's just for intimidation.
Exactly. Right. Like, so, you know, you can scare off the enemies provided you don't actually go ahead and smack them around, I suppose. There was also, you know, there was also some question about whether or not clerics could be armor, you know, wearing armor as well. A lot of the early canons sort of basically say, no, you know, that's just as bad. Wearing armor on a battlefield was sufficient, I think, in some of the Carolingian ones to actually be denied burial in Christian ground and stuff, because you were being punished for even just being there defending yourself, essentially just in armor. Yeah, so there was always these little exceptions where you could, you know, you could be on a battlefield as long as you were only praying, or, you know, you could have a weapon in certain areas as long as you didn't use it, or occasionally, like you see at Nablus, it's okay if you fight, but not really, you know. And they're trying to work this out. Like, when you look at the who is it? It's Ermenfried of Sion, I suppose, who does the penitential ordinance after the Battle of Hastings in 1070. There's a whole thing in there about, you know, what do we do with clerics and monks who came to the Battle of Hastings and fought, and they have to do penance. But then so does every other person in the army. It's just a different level of penance. And so they recognize that they shouldn't have been doing this, but it's part of this complaint that none of them should have been doing this. But that's also the last penitential ordinance you find for this sort of violence, as far as I know, at least in England, in the period that I'm studying. You know, no one else shows up in 1150 and says, hey, you all have to do penance for fighting battles against each other.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there is a difference between if you are on the offensive team or if you're on the defensive team. And it seems that there was, yeah?
Generally speaking, right, there is this sort of basic notion that defending yourself, defending your flock was kind of better. And we see that with the example from William of Newburgh, right, where the cleric who's putting together an army to go beat the snot out of people and take their land, that's bad. You know, he's a bad guy. Whereas the cleric who's basically putting together an army, you know, Cincinnatus style against his will and defending his people, that's okay. He's sort of a hero, or at least not doing something necessarily wrong. In general, I think you see that as well. I don't know that it's just offense defense. I think it's really more based around this concept of licitness. If you're defending the public good, such as they understood it, or the public order, which all, you know, 9 times out of 10 aligns with defending the king, defending the king's power, then that's okay. You know, for the most part, you're gonna get a lot more leeway than you're going to if you're like a rebellious baron, for instance. And you can see that in the rebellions of 1088 and 1100 against William II and Henry I of England, that the clerics who sort of like join up with the insurrectionists, whether it's, you know, Odo of Bayeux or William of Saint-Calais or whoever, they tend to get punished a lot more severely than folks like Wulfstan of Worcester, who is defending the legitimate king. And even though none of them are really supposed to be doing much about this. A great example would be somebody like Lanfranc, Archbishop of Canterbury, while in 1075, while the king is off in Normandy, and there's a rebellion. And Lanfranc coordinates the royal response to it, and, you know, like, one of his generals is Geoffrey, Bishop of Coutances, and he's like riding around kicking the crap out of these rebellious barons, and And I think Len Frank at one point writes a letter to William I, and it's like, don't come back yet, because we haven't crushed these rebels yet. You'll dishonor us if you turn up and take this away from us. We're kicking them over down. So clearly he doesn't think he needs to disassociate himself or anything like that, because he's defending the realm. And I think that that's where there's a lot of the difference, because there is that utility to maintaining public order through violence, that it's a lot harder to justify it when you're the one raising, you know, unfurling your banners in rebellion.
Is there an added wrinkle to the extent that you might be testing God's will if you're putting the bishop into this battle? Because, you know, the belief is that God is going to be on the side of the righteous.
Sure.
So was there any tension putting a bishop into battle that they might be kind of stacking the deck?
There could be. Well, as long as you're stacking the deck in your order, that's okay. Or on your side. Yeah. And this sort of, there is a line, right? I think there's a line that these bishops have to trod very carefully. And one of the best examples of it that I can think of that I talk about in the early part of the book is actually not English. He's French. Aymon, the Archbishop of Bourges, back in the early part of the 1130s and so forth. But during like the Peace Council efforts to ensure, you know, domestic tranquility and public order and all of that, he actually puts together I think it's called a peace league. There might be a peace militia. I'd have to go and check what the word is. But he basically leads this army of like lesser nobles and peasants and others, and forces knights and barons and whatnot to stop fighting. Like, he's basically God's avenger here. And all the write-up of him is great. It's fantastic. Until at one battle, he has a bunch of these folks at his mercy in one of the castles that he takes, and he executes them. And the chronicler is very clear about the fact that this was him sort of like falling into worldly pride and falling out of God's favor. And so in punishment, God put together an army of secular folks, and they just mop the floor with him. Probably helped that he was not a particularly great general. Let's be fair, he was a bishop. But like, that's how they understood it. That, yeah, this was totally okay until he ignored mercy, until he violated God's, you know, kind of precepts on it. And then God withdrew his support. But his support was there in the beginning, and that was the part of it that was really interesting to me. So yeah, I think clerics had to be very careful if they're fighting, because that criticism of, well, you're doing it for your own worldly benefit, obviously would wound them a lot more than if you said that to some earl, like, well, yeah, no kidding, that's why I'm doing it. You know, whereas the clerics, they didn't really have a lot of great defense against that. That's, I think, part of also why you find them fighting on behalf of the king a lot, because I think they saw that as their role, that, you know, my job is to safeguard the realm, safeguard the kingdom, safeguard, you know, Christian tranquility or whatever it happens to be. It's a lot easier to justify that by serving the legitimate government rather than some baron who wants to, you know, stockpile crossbows in his castle and lead you into rebellion.
As
some
you do
that too, to be fair, but it doesn't go too well for them usually.
Yeah, and crossbows are an interesting example, because crossbows were not supposed to be used against Christians.
Yeah, no, and that's one of the wild ones. When I actually get off my butt and write this article about weapons and clerics in war, Peter de Rocher is one of my favorites, because he is explicitly said to be leading the crossbowmen at the Battle of Lincoln. Like, that's his job. And I'd like to unpack that a bit more. That's a fascinating kind of thing. You know, on the one hand, I guess it makes sense. You know, if you're a cleric, especially if you became a cleric fairly young in life, you probably don't actually have a lot of training with weapons. You know, and that's also maybe why they're using maces instead of swords or staves, that, like, these guys aren't knights. You know, you can put on a suit of armor and you can give me a club, but I'm not a knight. I can maybe be a general, but, you know, and so maybe putting him in charge of the crossbowmen was seen as, yeah, that's something you can do and you won't mess it up. But you're right. There's this additional, like, canonical condemnation. But yeah, put the bishop in charge of the crossbowmen. Why not? Let's see what happens. But they win the battle, so I guess it works out pretty well.
All you have to do is point and shoot.
Point and shoot. Amen.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us, Craig, about warrior priests. I'm so happy to talk to you about this today.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
To find out more about Craig's work, you can follow him on Twitter at TheMedievalProf. You can find Warrior Churchmen of Medieval England on Amazon or on the Boydell and Brewer website. Before we go, here's Peter from MedievalIst.net telling us what's on the website. What's up, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Hey, it's just about time for Game of Thrones to come back for its final season. And that's always a big deal for us here at Medievalist.net because lots and lots of our fans love Game of Thrones. So, but we actually have a very interesting article that just came out this week. It's by Richard Utz, and it's asking, should Medievalists be teaching Game of Thrones? And spoiler alert, he doesn't think so. So it's very kind of interesting to look at, like, what is the value in it as a kind of this gateway drug to the Middle Ages. So because for us, it is gateway drug to medievalist.net. So so you'll see a lot of kind of posts coming out in the next few days, next week, you know, how much you love Game of Thrones and quizzes and things like that and whatever else we can find. But check out Richard's article.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
A massive thank you to those people who have signed up to be our patrons on Patreon. We are so happy to have your support, and it really does make a difference in helping us create the work that you love. If you'd like to get involved and you haven't already, we have 3 tiers for patrons: $1, $5, and $10. As an extra sweet deal, you can get a digital or paper subscription to Medieval Warfare magazine at either the $5 or the $10 level, respectively. You can find out more and get in on the action at patreon.com/medievalists. If you love medievalists.net, you can join our community on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on all your favorite social media platforms at 5minmedievalist. You can find my 5-Minute Medievalist books on Amazon, and while you're there, you can even pre-order my new one, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fictions. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thank you so much for lending me your ears each week and letting me share this time with you. Have yourself an awesome day.